Thank you very much. That's a very nice, generous introduction, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to be here. I particularly appreciate the American Age groups asking me, and particularly appreciate the opportunity to have a question period. I always look forward very much to that and would much prefer that to just making the statement. It always reminds me a little bit of the old story of the man who had imbibed too freely, came home much too late, and collapsed at the feet of his waiting wife. And from his position, all he could see were the tips of her slippers, but he could sense strong disapproval even from that. And so he said, "I have decided to set aside my prepared statement and take questions from the floor." And that is essentially what I hope to do, but I will make a little prepared statement first. We learn from the book of Deuteronomy that Moses, at the twilight of his life, summoned the children of Israel together and reminded them of God's commandments and ended with the words, "I set before you life or death, blessing or curse. Choose life then so that you and your descendants may live." And he spoke to the Israelites as individuals, but he also spoke to them as a nation, reminding them that they shared a common responsibility and therefore could share a common fate. So too, religious leaders call us, not just as men and women responsible for our individual souls, but as a nation responsible for our common fate to choose life. But it is life with freedom. Let me then firmly state my disagreement right at the start with those who say that the Catholic bishops and other religious authorities should not be addressing the weighty questions posed by modern arms. You will not hear from me anything about rendering unto Caesar today, because life and freedom are gifts not of Caesar, but of God. And the charge to choose life is also a political responsibility, and it's echoed in our own Declaration of Independence and in our Constitution. And in the age of nuclear weapons, this charge has taken on new meaning for all peoples and for religious and political leaders alike. Because now a nation truly can choose between life and death, between freedom or slavery, between peace with freedom, or the kind of tortured peace such as Poland endures, without freedom. And it chooses not just for itself, but for all of its descendants. And our constitutional responsibility to provide for the common defense is an awesome responsibility. It poses terrible questions, and it imposes terrible burdens and calculations on all of us. And there is very, very little margin for error in those calculations. In confronting these questions and calculations, which I have to do every day as Secretary of Defense, casting up these terrible equations, I'm fully aware of their moral implications. I agree with the introduction to the third draft of the pastoral letter, the one on war and peace, the quotation that says, "There is no satisfactory answer to the human problem of the nuclear age which fails to consider the moral and the religious dimensions of the questions that we face." So today, in speaking about these moral and religious questions and dimensions to nuclear deterrence, I'd like to speak from two perspectives, that of an individual Christian and that of the Secretary of Defense. Don't mistake me now. I don't believe that these two roles are in any way incompatible, but they do present several inherent challenges, and it is to these challenges that I would like to speak. I've been forced to confront all of these challenges, and of course so will you as the future leaders of this nation. Consider the biblical implication to love your enemy. The individual Christian is called on to turn the other cheek, to give those who would take not his coat, but also his cloak. And yet a Christian acting on behalf of his nation, or in the case of the United States, on behalf of an alliance of free nations, simply cannot turn the cheek of innocent people toward their aggressors, or indeed hand over the fruits of other people's labors. Pope John the 23rd recognized the protective duty of Christian statesmen in his encyclical Pacem in Terris, in which he said, "The safety of the commonwealth is not only the first law, but it is a government's whole reason for existence." The Catholic Church, as the pastor of letter points out, has always been prepared to relate moral principles to concrete problems. And we are greatly indebted, for example, to individuals like Terence Cardinal Cook and the military vicar and the military chaplains for their support and counsel to our servicemen and women. And here at this renowned Catholic institution, it is fitting that we consider the guidance that the Church has given to political leaders for two millennia now. Since the days when Christians served in the Roman army, the Church has been helping people decide when to fight and when to lay down arms, when the state is acting justly and when it is imposing injustice. Today, the leaders of the Church continue that important role. His Holiness Pope John Paul II, in his message for the 15th World Day of Peace, summed up the Church's teaching in this way. Christians, he said, even as they strive to resist and prevent every form of warfare, have a right and even a duty to protect their existence and their freedom by proportionate means against an unjust aggressor. And he gave a special caution for this in this nuclear age when he said that war is the most barbarous and the least effective way of resolving conflicts. Americans are well aware of this truth. We're not a warlike people. Twice in the first half of this century, we resisted involvement in foreign wars. Twice, we finally had to face our moral obligation to resist aggression and to come to the aid of friends and allies. By the end of World War II, we found ourselves almost inadvertently the richest and the most powerful nation in the world and in the sole possession of the most terrible weapons mankind has ever possessed. With our monopoly on nuclear weapons, the United States sought not to control or to dominate the world. We sought instead, through the Baruch Plan, to put these weapons under international control. With our material wealth, the United States sought not to establish an empire, but to rebuild democracy and rekindle economic growth for friend and for foe alike. We tried, and I think perhaps harder than any other nation in history has tried before, to love those who had been our enemies and to seek peace and to pursue it. Indeed, it has been said somewhat jokingly that the surest road to prosperity is for a nation to be defeated by the United States in war. In seeking peace, however, we pursue the strategy of deterrence, and that has been the basis of the defense policy of the United States ever since George Washington. In the very first State of the Union address, he told the Congress that to be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace. But nuclear deterrence... Now, nuclear deterrence, of course, poses a most difficult paradox. It is the paradox that to ensure that these terrible weapons are never used, we have to demonstrate that we are willing and able to use them to respond to an attack against us. We will not make a first strike. It is this uncomfortable paradox that we've had to live with all through the atomic age. But it's also this paradox of deterrence that for almost 40 years has kept the peace and has preserved our freedom. Not only has deterrence worked, but it is consistent with many principles of Catholic teaching on war and the use of nuclear weapons, and most of these have been discussed in the third draft of the Pastoral Letter on War and Peace. Our national policy and the Catholic teachings are both based on a presumption against war and for the peaceful settlement of disputes. Together, we reject offensive war of any kind. Together, we acknowledge that every nation has a right and a duty to defend itself against unjust aggression. And the Church denounces a policy of using nuclear weapons for the purpose of destroying population centers or other predominantly civilian targets. And so does the United States in our targeting policy. The Church supports immediate, bilateral, verifiable agreements to curb the testing, the production, and the deployment of new nuclear weapon systems, and the United States is actively pursuing just such agreements in Geneva, where we are trying to achieve major reductions in the arsenals of war. Not just means of allowing a limited increase, but major reductions. And above all, Church and the United States, Church and Nation agree that there could be no winners in a nuclear war. All mankind would lose. The pastor letter also reflects a concern which President Reagan has raised in his recent speech to the American people when he spoke about defense. And he said, would it not be better to save lives than to avenge them? And his answer was to propose that we try to develop a whole new system, that would be a reliable defense against incoming nuclear missiles. Pope John Paul II has called on us to seek a better way. And in a world where we cannot simply banish the knowledge of these terrible weapons, defense against missiles may indeed be such a better way. But I don't want to pretend that there are no disagreements about nuclear strategy or that we have resolved all of the challenges of deterrence. We should turn then, I think, to three of those challenges that we must keep before us as we debate the morality of war and peace in the nuclear age. And the first, of course, has to be the horror of all wars. We must seek to prevent not just another Hiroshima or a bombing of London or a Bataan. When 50 million people died in World War II, it was a lesson for all times that the Holocaust can occur without a nuclear war. The nuclear deterrence that we extend to our allies, then, has to protect them not just against nuclear threats, but working with our allies, it has to protect us all against the awesome conventional power of the Soviet Union, a power that the Soviets have shown them perfectly willing to use in Hungary, and in Czechoslovakia, in Afghanistan, and through intimidation today in Poland. A power that's demonstrated also in their use of chemical and toxic weapons in violation of all their treaty obligations against soldiers and civilians alike. The draft pastoral letter's acknowledgement that a change in strategy of extended deterrence would require an alternate defense posture is absolutely correct. And let us recognize as well that such an emphasis on conventional weapons would require far larger defense budgets and far more men in arms. But we know that we have to prepare and defend and deter both conventional and nuclear attacks. Well, another part of this whole debate about nuclear arms in the nuclear age emphasizes another challenge. The United States, as I have said, rejects a strategy which targets nuclear weapons against population centers. But to maintain a credible deterrent, we must be able to retaliate against military targets that the Soviets have protected, or so-called hardening against attack. For this, we need very modern and accurate weapons. And also, we need better command and control communications and intelligence capabilities. And that's a priority which is first among the President's programs, and it is also a priority which, as I understand it, is supported by the pastoral letter. Yet some say that more accurate weapons make nuclear war easier to imagine and easier to begin. Well, I would just have to respond to that by asking, would it be more ethical to use that argument to justify maintaining less accurate weapons that could only attack population centers? The answer, of course, is no. But that is one of the inherent problems of the nuclear age. And it's complicated by the fact that the accuracy, the extreme accuracy that the Soviets have obtained with their weapons, unfortunately, has largely been obtained by our own technology, either sold to them or stolen by them. We in the United States are under no illusions about the dangers of nuclear war. We know that neither side could win such a war, but this recognition on our part is not enough by itself to prevent the outbreak of nuclear war. The Soviet leadership must also recognize it. And the best way to secure that recognition is for us to maintain a retaliatory, not a first strike, a retaliatory capability that is indeed the essence of deterrence. And so that raises really the third challenge. And the third challenge is the behavior of the Soviet Union, a regime which explicitly rejects the laws and the love of God. And we have to remember that during the 70s, we made a conscious choice to restrict our nuclear weapons to and all of their future developments, so that the Soviet Union would not feel that we were trying to acquire or indeed had a first strike threat, and therefore first strike intentions. But the Soviets didn't follow that self-imposed restraint. We hoped they would. We hoped for a number of things that would bring about a situation in which we need not engage in deterrence at the levels that we now have to engage in to maintain deterrence. We tried the taunt, and we tried negotiations for SALT agreements. We tried a number of things. But nothing restrained the enormous, continuing, very rapid increase in Soviet military power. They developed several new intercontinental ballistic missiles with great accuracy, as I say, largely taken from our own technology. And these accurate missiles are specifically designed to destroy the U.S. Silos and the air bases of the B-52s. And they continue to design and then to deploy a vast array of additional weapons that threaten us and our allies. Today, we see that the number, the explosive power, and the accuracy of these nuclear weapons are far greater than would be needed simply to deter attack. In fact, they represent a potential first strike capability. And in addition, they've developed a refiring capability. That is, they can use their launchers repeatedly. And this is a capability we do not have. And it's a capability which makes most of the traditional number counting quite irrelevant. Also, they've given us indications that they think they could limit damage to themselves from a nuclear war by hardening their silos, protecting their key targets with elaborate air defense, by investing very large amounts in civil defense, and through their writings, their military doctrine, and all of their exercises emphasize the kind of nuclear war fighting that we have rejected and which we must deter. We will never deter war if we do not look these truths in the face. Winston Churchill once said that Neville Chamberlain lacked imagination in evil. But as Pope John Paul reminded us in his message for the Day of Peace, Christians are aware that plans based on aggression, domination, and the manipulation of others lurk in human hearts. So we need imagination in peace, too, that beautiful word which is so freely used and so readily abused. There is great danger that we will ask too little of peace and that we will seek no positive vision for our world. The pastoral letter shared this concern. It quoted from the pastoral constitution of Vatican II, and it said that peace is not merely the absence of war, nor can it be reduced solely to the maintenance of a balance of power between enemies, nor indeed is it brought about by dictatorship. Indeed, it is rightly and appropriately called an enterprise of justice. So when Christ said, "It is not peace I come to bring, but a sword," I do not think that he meant that his followers should take up arms to spread his gospel. Indeed, he rebuked them when some interpreted his words so. But I do believe that religion and morality call us to judge between good and evil and to recognize that injustice is an offense against peace, even where there is no formal war. So let us not lose confidence that America has a special mission for peace. Our Constitution calls us to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, and we take that very seriously. Our leadership in the free world calls us to help our friends and our allies deter aggression and preserve and foster democratic freedom. Our strategy of deterrence, then, is really a strategy for a richer peace, a peace with liberty, with justice, and with the freedom to follow the dictates of God and each one's conscience. To choose less is not to choose life, in the true and full sense of that blessing. Well, I've enjoyed very much your extremely courteous reception of this speech. Thank you.
subject to face off. Throughout the American Navy, gave four students the opportunity to submit questions, which will now be directed to Mr. Weinberg. American Navy students went throughout the week those questions, which felt the most representative of the questions ever received. So, Mr. Weinberg, if you'd like to get that podium. The first question is, what is your reaction to the President of America's Congressional Conference last night regarding the threat of the U.S. from Central America?
The question was about the reaction to the President's address. Not surprisingly, I support it thoroughly. I think that it is extremely important to realize two things. One is that what we are trying to do is to support the continuance of a regularly elected, duly legally chosen government to be free of harassment from outside, externally supported sources, and that in doing that, we have to bear in mind the critically important geographical strategic position of this country, which is on the mainland of our continent, and whose fall could constitute a major threat, ultimately, to the security and peace of continental United States. We simply can't afford to have another Soviet-sponsored Cuba on the mainland.
Would you like to just read them? Is that easier? Okay. The next question regards arms reduction. You maintain that the Reagan administration is increasing its military budget solely for the purpose of attaining military parity with the Soviet Union. You also state that when parity is reached, serious arms negotiation talks can begin. If this is so, why did President Reagan select Kenneth Edelman as chief arms negotiator when Mr. Edelman said at a Senate confirmation hearing that arms negotiations are a pretense put on to appease the American public?
Right there. There are a couple of assumptions in the question that I have to correct first, and then I will try to answer it. I do not maintain that we are increasing our budget solely for the purpose of attaining military parity, nor do I state that when parity is reached, serious arms negotiation talks can begin. Serious arms negotiation talks have been going on for over a year now, and they are serious, and it is one of the most deeply held precepts and hopes of the President that they will succeed. What we seek to increase our military budget for is two things. It is to make up for a decade of neglect, and it is to ensure not that we have superiority, but that we always retain a sufficient degree of strength to deter a first attack. The essence of deterrence is that you have a sufficient degree of retaliatory capability after a first strike, because we have no aggressive intentions. We fight a defensive strategy always, and that does not require military superiority, but it does require that we have to regain considerably more strength than we have now, because we didn't do it during a period of 10 years, and the Soviets, for a period of 21 years, have been increasing theirs enormously. Now, we do that, and we don't say that arms reduction negotiations have to wait for that or anything. We've been engaged in arms reduction negotiations since, I think, November of 1981, and it is essential that we continue them, and we are, both at the intermediate range level, at the strategic intercontinental level, and at the conventional level. And the selection of Mr. Edelman was because he is a very able man, and he did not say, and he certainly does not believe, that arms negotiations are a mere pretense. It is one of the perhaps most seriously held beliefs of the President. You know, I've had the great privilege of working with the President for almost 19 years now, and of knowing him that long. Worked with him in California before he was elected governor and since, and here in Washington. And I know that one of the things that is closest to his heart, one of the things he most wants, is to achieve peace and to do it for his time and for all time. And he knows that the only way that we can bring that about is to maintain deterrence. And the other way to do it is to maintain deterrence at vastly lower levels than we're able to do now. And if you can get deterrence at vastly lower levels, down to the point where you are indeed at parity, and this requires what they call in disarmament circles an asymmetrical reduction. What it means in simple terms is the Soviets have to come down more than we do to get down to parity, down to equality, and then if it's fully verifiable, then we can maintain that the deterrence at much lower levels. And beyond that, as you know from the President's proposal, he wants to go all the way down to zero on the intermediate range weapon. And he also wants ultimately to achieve a reliable defense, so that at least against these most terrible of all weapons, we will have a reliable way of preventing them ever being used again. So the President's commitment to peace, to arms reduction, is absolute and complete. It is the thing he holds most dear, and our increases in the defense budget are to maintain the peace through deterrence, a policy that every United States president has had since our first president.
The United States government has, on numerous occasions, played a central role in destabilizing and overthrowing popularly elected governments throughout the world. Chile in 1973, Iran in 1953, and Guatemala in 1954 are just some of the many examples that are well documented. In many cases, such as Iran in 1953, the CIA has even agreed with this documentation. How can you reconcile these historical facts with the government's claims that U.S. defense and foreign policies are based on a protection and support for democracy and freedom? Right.
Let me, at the outset, acknowledge that not everything every American government has ever been has done has ever always been totally correct, nor has it been totally right. In each of these particular examples, there were a number of factors which don't come right into the question. And Iran in 1953 was not a government that was popularly elected in any sense of the term. It was a government installed. It was a government installed by agents of the Soviet Union, and it was a government that practiced the worst kind of repression. Now, it's an interesting thing that Iran was picked, because a few years ago, when the Shah's government was falling, a great many people in the United States, in Washington, and elsewhere in the world said that it would be terribly immoral to support a government like the Shah's, because it had elements of repression in it, and that what we should do was to let it fall, or indeed aid it to fall. In any event, the Shah's government fell, and what happened? We now have the most repressive government that the world has seen since the Middle Ages. And so that you do not have a situation that is quite as simple or quite as easy as that. And bear in mind that a lot of these examples that were mentioned are not examples of situations in which we were dealing with regularly, popularly elected or chosen governments. We are dealing with such a government in El Salvador. We are trying to help it help itself to survive. And we have our own vital interests at stake, as well as our interest in preserving and encouraging an improving government that is looking now towards such things as land reform and other things of that kind.
In light of recent demonstrations in Western Europe and the growing momentum among the European people in support of nuclear disarmament, how can the United States justify its objective of placing Pershing II and cruise missiles in this area of the world?
A very brief excursion into history. In December 1979, a unanimous NATO asked to have the two tracks of a decision pursued. They asked to have the United States deploy the only counter that was then available and is still available and is not now deployed to the SS-20. The SS-20 is a Soviet intermediate-range missile that has a range sufficient to destroy any city or any target in Europe and turned the other way to destroy any target in Asia. And that missile is mobile. and it's very easy to hide. It has three very deadly accurate warheads, and there's no counter to it in Western Europe. And in December 79, NATO asked two things. They asked to have the United States deploy these ground-launched cruise missiles and the Pershing 2, and they asked that serious arms reduction negotiations get underway. Both of those tracks are being followed. The President's proposal at Geneva was not just to reduce INF forces, not just to reduce the numbers of ground-launched cruise missiles or Pershing 2s that would be put in to counter the 1,050 warheads of the SS-20s that are there now, deployed and ready to shoot. It was to eliminate all of them, to eliminate the SS-20s and not to deploy a single Pershing missile or a single ground-launched cruise missile. And that proposal was not accepted by the Soviet Union. And our European allies said, please make another proposal. Don't just insist on that one. Show some flexibility. And so the President proposed an interim proposal, another way of reaching zero, which was to come down to a level that would be determined by negotiation and have the Soviets come down to that same level as the first stage, then move to zero after that. And again, that has not yet been accepted, but it is being seriously negotiated by the Soviets. At no time did the NATO resolution, nor have any of the individual governments concerned, taken the position that the deployment of the missiles called for by the first track of this resolution not be deployed. And we are convinced, in view of the history of negotiations with the Soviets and their behavior at Geneva now, that unless and until this deployment is made, and it is ready to be made starting this fall, and all of the mechanical things are on schedule, unless that deployment goes forward, you will not have any serious negotiations with the Soviets, because they will simply not have any incentive to take out any of their 1,050 warheads of the SS-20 that are already deployed and ready to shoot. Why should they? They will know that the West lacks the will to deploy any counter, and of course they won't remove theirs. But if the West goes ahead with the deployment, then we may hope to get a major reduction, I hope all the way to zero. And whatever goes in the way of ground-launched cruise missiles or Pershing 2s can come out. It will be expensive, but it will be more than worth it if we can remove these weapons from the face of Europe, and indeed from the face of the world because of their range.
What are your reactions to the report of the Scowcroft Commission, which, among other things, de-emphasized the supposed window of vulnerability, which both you and President Reagan cited as a major factor to justify increased defense outlays?
Well, because the Scowcroft Commission did not find that, I support it. What the Scowcroft Commission found was that the MX missile should be deployed as soon as possible, that we should also hunt for and search out and try to develop as quickly as we could a new single-headed intercontinental missile that would be mobile and hence more survivable, that all of the elements of the President's strategic program, including the replacement of the air leg of the Triad and the strengthening of the submarine-based leg of the Triad, continue, and that we improve our communications command and control. These are not the recommendations of a commission that says there is no need to do any of these things. They said exactly the opposite. There is a problem. There is a period, and going to be a period, when there will be a strategic imbalance, when the Soviets will have a lead in certain areas, as I've indicated they have in the intermediate range. And it is the responsibility of those of us charged with office now to do everything we can to persuade the American Congress that it is essential to have the appropriations necessary to not allow this imbalance to continue. The danger of war grows proportionately as any perception is allowed to exist in the minds of the Soviet military planners that a first strike by them could succeed, could not be met with sufficient degrees of retaliatory strength so as to deter them from ever making it. And it's when they begin to get that belief, based on a degree of superiority that they've obtained by huge investments over the years without surcease for 21 years, that the danger of war grows. So the Scowcroft Commission recognized this. They recognized that by whatever name you want to call it, that it is essential to close that gap, to right that balance, and at the same time to pursue vigorously the arms reduction that we're talking about.
In a letter written to Secretary George Shultz, to Representative Long, he said in reference to El Salvador, and I quote, "The military effort is essential to provide the shield we need to succeed in our broader efforts. First, what are these broader efforts? And second, is it justified to increase the level of tension and probably the death toll in El Salvador by providing more military aid and to increase internal dissension among Americans concerning the necessity of foreign intervention, which seems to be which seems to many reminiscent of the sentiments during the Vietnam era in pursuit of these broader efforts?"
Well, I'm really delighted that question was asked, because it is important to know what Secretary of State Shultz meant when he was talking about the broader effort. The broader effort is to secure a situation of sufficient stability so that our economic aid, which, as the President said last night, is in the ratio of 77%, 77 cents of every dollar of aid is economic aid, so that that economic aid can take effect and have some beneficial effect in reducing and relieving the hideous poverty in which most of these countries suffer. The Caribbean Basin Initiative of the President is one that's designed to do this on a regional basis. That's the broader aim. But you can't get anyone to invest, you can't get any kind of effective use of economic aid if it has to be spent entirely on repairing bridges or repairing roads or trying to get new railroad stock or basic infrastructures of those countries that have been destroyed by war. And so it is essential that we stabilize the military situation. The question says, how can it be justified to increase the level of tension and probably the death toll by providing more military aid? Bear in mind, the death toll and the tension is there. And the question is whether you want to allow a whole people to be overrun or whether you want to allow a situation that existed the last time that they had elections a few months ago, in which the people who came out of the hills to vote were physically assaulted and wounded in many cases and prevented in every way possible, or at least attempted to be prevented, from voting. And that didn't succeed, because more than 80% of the people in El Salvador voted despite that. It was indeed, as all of the international observers said, a free election. Incidentally, that 80% is considerably higher than we turn out here.
Do you feel that it is more advantageous to spend a larger part of the defense budget on personnel, salary, and benefits to attract and retain the most qualified labor force, or should the primary expenditure of funds of the U.S. military be devoted to high-technology hardware?
Well, we are doing a very large part of our budget in the form of personnel benefits and salaries. Over 51% of our budget, our defense budget, goes for that. So that when people talk about military spending, it is important to bear in mind the actual anatomy of the defense budget. Over 51% for many years has gone for personnel. And it's working. We have on the all-volunteer armed force, and bear in mind the President and I are totally and completely opposed to a draft, we have now a situation in which we are recruiting more people than we actually have funds for. We have a situation in which we have waiting lines at all of the major recruiting offices, and we are retaining very good people who have received the training, and we are also recruiting people, far more of them, 78% now with high school graduation completed, rather than some 54% a few years ago. And in every way, we are very pleased with both the quality and the quantity and the willingness of these very able people to stay on and do these very difficult tasks that help all of us. We do, however, of course, have to have some funds spent for high technology. And the reason, of course, is that this is not a world of our making, and we have to maintain an effective deterrent. And indeed, the only way we can do that is to have the kind of continued retaliatory capability in the face of some very powerful, high-technology, extremely sophisticated weapons that the Soviets have. And so we always have to look at what is necessary to maintain deterrence. Deterrence is a moving picture. It is a changing picture. And it can only be based on what we believe the Soviets will correctly perceive as a sufficient degree of strength so that it will deter them from attacking. That is a strategy that has worked now for something like 37 years. And it is a strategy, as I say, which every American administration has followed. So, yes, we are going to increase our benefits. Over half our budget goes for that purpose. We want it to be just that way. In the Soviet Union, do you know what goes for personnel benefits from their budget? 16%. And that says a lot between the differences of the systems. But we're going to do that, but we also have to look at the importance of maintaining the kind of high technology that is essential to continue to maintain the deterrence, which is the only course that can bring us peace.
Mr. Weinberger, on behalf of Fordham University, thank you very much. Your visit here will long be remembered.